The Institute for Faith and Freedom at Grove City College presents Keeping the Faith with your host, Senior Fellow Joe Wolcott.
Psalm 24, The King of Glory, a Psalm of David. The earth is the Lord's, and the fullness thereof, the world and those who dwell therein, for he has founded it upon the seas, and established it upon the rivers. Who shall ascend the hill of the Lord, and who shall stand in his holy place? He who has clean hands and a pure heart, who does not lift up his soul to what is false, and does not swear deceitfully, he will receive the blessing from the Lord, and righteousness from the God of his salvation. Such is the generation of those who seek him, who seek the face of the God of Jacob, Selah. Lift up your heads, O gates, and be lifted up, O ancient doors, that the King of Glory may come in. Who is this King of Glory? The Lord, strong and mighty, the Lord, mighty in battle. Lift up your heads, O gates, and lift them up, O ancient doors, that the King of Glory may come in. Who is this King of Glory? The Lord of hosts. He is the King of Glory. Selah. Welcome back to Keeping the Faith. I am your host, Joseph Wolcott, and we have a really fun episode in store for you all today. So much of our everyday life is spent in contact with the free market, whether you go to the grocery store, maintain your car, or even have some sort of trade with a friend. Much of life is built upon the principles of the free market. This begs several questions. What are the key principles and functions of the free market? What does the Bible say about economic life? How do we, as 21st century Christians, apply our Christian principles in a free market setting? Here to help me answer these questions and more is Dr. Sean Rittenour. Dr. Rittenour is a professor of economics at Grove City College and a senior fellow at the Ludwig von Mises Institute. He is the author of his treatise, Foundations of Economics, A Christian View, which I can personally recommend, and editor of the Mises Reader. He has written scores of chapters, articles, and editorials published in venues such as the American Journal of Economics and Sociology, Quarterly Journal of Austrian Economics, Journal of Market Processes, the Pittsburgh Tribune, and the Wall Street Journal. He earned a BA in economics from Northwestern College in Orange City, Iowa, and a PhD in economics from Auburn University. His latest book, The Economics of Prosperity, Rethinking Economic Growth and Development, was awarded the 2023 George F. Kother Award for Free Market Writing. Dr. Rittenour, welcome to the show.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
Well, thank you for coming. Before we get into the practical matters of this episode, let's start with the basics of the setting we're both working in here, because Grove City has a particular school of economic thought we emphasize here. So what is that school, and I guess how would it differentiate itself from other popular schools of thought?
Yeah, so I would say Grove City College is known for teaching economics within the so-called Austrian school. A better more generic description of it would be, say, the human action school, the praxeological school. It's a school that emphasizes the fact that all economic phenomena is a result of human action. And for us to derive economic principles that are relevant to the real world in which we live, we need to develop principles from this implication of the reality of human action. So what would differentiate us from other schools would be not relying on artificial, arbitrary models that are built upon arbitrary assumptions or on the other hand, different schools that are increasingly trying to, in some sense, toss out a lot of economic theory altogether and focusing just on economic history or big data. What we want to do is, based on the reality of human action, identify those certain general principles that are true in all action, and if they're true in all action, then they're necessarily true in economic interaction, and therefore we can derive principles that are both realistic and true and helpful for us to navigate our lives in a world of economic exchange, and of course allow us then to make better decisions about economic policy that are actually based on economic law, true economic law.
Okay, excellent. So let's start with the basics. What are the biblical principles that shape our economic philosophy as Christians?
Yes, well, there are a number of them. I could say one thing that informs us as professors at Grove City and sort of encourages us to pursue economics in this human action vein is the fact that all humans are made in God's image. Mm-hmm. And as such, we have the ability to investigate creation and identify various types of scientific laws. God created the world with regularities, both natural and social, so that we can actually scientific laws in the natural world and in the social world that they're there for us to discover. So we can actually engage in economics mm-hmm. as a social science. Mm-hmm. Then additionally, we recognize that because we're made in God's image, we all, like God, engage in purposeful behavior. We engage in human action. We apply means
according to ideas to achieve ends.
That's right, exactly. You've learned something. Mm-hmm. Very good. And so on the basis of that, we can then identify certain laws that exist and then allow those our understanding of these laws to – such as, say, the law of supply and the law of demand to explain how prices are formulated and that kind of thing. So we recognize at the very least that there are – scientific laws as they pertain to economics, just as much as we could say there's the law of gravity or the laws mm-hmm. of thermodynamics, et cetera, et cetera. Mm-hmm. So that's one thing one place where there's an intersection between Christian doctrine and the foundations of economics. In addition to that, we also know that Scripture provides us, in some sense, a theological justification for the discipline beyond the fact that, like all creation, the laws of economics declare God's glory. Mm-hmm. On top of that, we know that God gives us the creation mandate or the cultural mandate in Genesis 1 and 2 to be fruitful, multiply, to exercise dominion, to work and keep. If we look at that mandate where we are called to rule, we're called to fill, be fruitful, multiply, we're called to work creation, we're called to keep or guard or replenish the earth and subdue it. We're called to do that now in a fallen world of what I call aggravated scarcity, a scarcity that is even worse than it was before because of the curse. How do we do this? Well, economics tells us and informs us and gives us many principles that we can use to better fulfill the cultural mandate. So principles such as law of comparative advantage or the law of association and the blessings we get from the market division of labor, the blessings we get from capital formation, the blessings we get from wise entrepreneurship and allocating goods to their most highly valued ends so that we're not squandering, we're not wasting goods, but we have an incentive to use those goods wisely. Mm-hmm. And to use them in a way that actually allows us to replenish creation, not just spoil it and destroy it. Mm-hmm. So the cultural mandate then really provides a justification for why we do economics. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, there's issues related to the ethics of property that then should guide us to a large extent on how we pursue economic policy. The ethics of property, the Christian ethics of property, rooted in, say, partly the chapter that you just read from at the beginning of the show, the earth is the Lord's, right? God owns everything that there is, for he made it. Mm-hmm. And then by analogy, the things that we make, we own. And the commandment against theft then protects us from arbitrarily taking of our property from either other regular citizens or the state, right? And so that would then inform our understanding of economic policy. So there's a lot of areas where the scriptures give us principles and guidance about how we approach economics as a social science, how we do applied economics with related to private property. And then, of course, other things that we should also think about is just individually, what are we called to do with our property, right? Mm-hmm. You know, we're going to be – there's economic policy, and then there is, you know, like with respect to what the state allows, but then there's also the account that we're going to have to give before the Lord about how did we use the property that he set before us.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, very good. And yeah, there's a lot of good stuff there to work with. Let's start by picking at some of the principles you laid out there. Are there particular strains of economic thought that run contrary to some of those biblical principles? I've got at least one in mind that I think we would both agree on.
Well, there are probably several, actually. Mm-hmm. But I mean, you know, one clear example would be those economists and politicians and people that say would advocate some type of socialism, mm-hmm. or Marxism, communism, the idea that we need to abolish private property so that we get to some type of great utopia where everybody has a good share of everything that they need and a lot of what they want. That, of course, is that type of arrangement when people don't have any private property, where the state owns everything. That is completely antithetical to what we find in the scriptures. Mm-hmm. And I even like, I mean, there are certain people that I've seen, certain Christian socialists, people who call themselves Christian socialists, will point to, say, Acts chapter 5 and the account of Ananias and Sapphira as an example of, aha, you see, that's a teaching where, Ananias and Sapphira were killed by the Lord because they held back and they kept some property for themselves. So that's the exact opposite of what that passage teaches. They mm-hmm. were killed for lying to the Holy Spirit, mm-hmm. and in the discussion, in the statements of Peter before the death judgment is brought, Peter explicitly tells them that the property was theirs to do with as they wanted. They didn't have to sell the property, and they didn't have to donate any proceeds that they didn't want to. So the problem was not that they kept back some from themselves. Mm-hmm. The problem was that they lied to God about it by lying to the church. And so I think that's one clear principle that we don't find that we find no traction in Scripture for, is this idea of sort of mandated socialism or forced state.
I've seen Christian socialists try and argue from the chapter immediately preceding that as well, saying that when it describes the Christians as sharing everything in common among each other,
yes.
Unpack that a little bit.
Yeah, that's a case where first of all, we should note that whatever that they were doing was completely voluntary, in the sense mm-hmm. it wasn't coerced by the state. No one was forced to mm-hmm. Have their goods all in common. They had their goods all in common, meant that they treated their goods as if they were freely sharing them with others who were in significant need, because in that historical period, if you profess faith in Christ, this is in Jerusalem, you are getting cut off from your family, you're getting mm-hmm. cut off from your relatives, you're getting cut off from any means of inheritance, any means of support. Mm-hmm. So it was much more materially costly to be a Christian there and then than it is now. And so there were a number of people that were facing a potential destitution, and so the Christians that had property didn't grasp and grasp their own property. They freely gave, they freely shared. It's essentially a sharing of consumption, right? At best, it's having consumer goods in common. There's nothing in that passage in Acts that suggests a socialization of the means of production, mm-hmm. or anything like that. So, at best, it's simply illustrating Christian sharing in love. It's mm-hmm. not a mandated program, and it's not a pattern for – it's not an economic pattern for an economic system, mm-hmm. really.
Yeah. And I guess the two of us putting down socialism, that's a pretty popular take here at Grove City. I'm curious to pry a little bit, because you said there are several that come to mind. So going beyond socialism.
Sure. I mean, socialism is like the low-hanging fruit, if you mm-hmm. will. But, I mean, if you think about there are some who would advocate, for instance, if we're in the midst of a recession, like we were, say, 2008. Well, the Federal Reserve needs to inflate the money supply. There needs to be a central bank like the Federal Reserve that's supposed to maintain the optimal supply of money, and we need to increase the money supply so as banks have adequate liquidity, and so the financial markets will be stable, and we won't have this massive recession, we won't have as much unemployment, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Well, all that fails to see that the negative consequences and frankly unethical consequences of having one entity monopolize the legally monopolize the monetary system that allows them to increase the money supply by giving additional money into the hands of their pals, of their cronies. Mm-hmm. And those people, of course, who get the new money first are able to enjoy higher purchasing power right off the bat and are able to go out and buy a host of goods that they want to buy before any prices have changed and direct wealth towards themselves. And as they direct wealth towards themselves, of course, as the money starts to matriculate through the economy, prices begin to get bid up. But there's always going to be people in the caboose of the inflation train. They're at the end of that process. Those people that they may get a little bit of the new money, but the prices throughout the economy will have already risen to the point where the little money that they do get is not enough to offset the higher prices. Now, these people mm-hmm. are obviously harmed. And then, of course, there are people on fixed pensions, often elderly people, that won't see a dime of the new money but still have to pay higher prices mm-hmm. because the prices have been bid up throughout the economy by people getting the new money. Mm-hmm. And so this type of monetary inflation is government-imposed redistribution of wealth from the people – from the people that get the money later or not at all to the people that get the new money first. Mm-hmm. And so I think that basically is a form of violation of the right to property. Mm-hmm. If you or I did that, it'd be called counterfeiting, but if mm-hmm. the government does it through the Federal Reserve, that's called monetary policy.
Yeah. So I think we've laid a really good biblical groundwork here. So let's move to the market itself. What are the key principles of a free market economic system?
Well, the key principle of a free market economic system is that people have the right to property. In other words, they have the right to own property, to use their property as they see fit, to use it to produce the goods that they think are wise to produce, and then to exchange those goods as they see fit. It includes the right to dispose of the goods as they see fit. So the market economy itself could be called specialization in the division of labor in an institutional setting of private property. And so in many respects, what we think, we just look around and we think we have a free market. Well, the market's not actually completely free, right? Mm-hmm. There's a lot of monetary distortion in there. There's a lot of regulation. There's a lot of price controls in there. And then they're increasingly talking about price controls. You know, they're recently now they've been floating this idea that the increased price inflation we've seen over the last couple of years is due to corporate greed. So we're going to bust these corporations for price gouging because prices are being raised. Well, that's a form of hampering the market. That's a form of mm-hmm. government regulation. It turns out that you can't even legally sell a corn dog unless it matches a government regulation. There's a government standard for corn dog. There's a certain ratio of cornmeal coating to meat hot dog that you have to maintain, or you can't sell it legally. You'll get a letter from our friends at the government. And so we think we live in a free market, but actually we live in a very much hampered market. But it's still a market, right? People are still mm-hmm. able to trade goods as long as they meet, certain regulations and that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. But the principle of the free market is simply that people are able to use their property and exchange their property as they see fit. So people mm-hmm. are free to a society where people have the right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, mm-hmm. or property. Is life, liberty, and property is the old saying, but then Jefferson changed it to, you know, the right to the pursuit of happiness. Doesn't we have the right to happiness, just the right to pursue happiness, right? Mm-hmm. To use our property to produce and exchange as we see fit. Those are really the principles of the free market.
Yeah, very good. So like you said, we live in a hampered market, but, you know, I think I would be preaching to the choir a bit to say to our Institute for Faith and Freedom audience that we certainly want minimal government control on the market. Mm-hmm. Like, if at all, what is the ideal place of government in a market system?
Yeah, that's a good question. I would say to the extent that we have a magistrate, that magistrate there exists to protect life and property from aggression. And beyond that, really not much, right? So it's basically to preserve peace, to give people a feeling of security in their property, so they should feel that they're not in danger of having their property stolen from, people breaking into their house, people defrauding them. So the magistrate would prosecute theft, they would prosecute fraud, and at the same time, the state would not perpetuate fraud and would not promote or participate in thievery themselves, right? So they would not, they would refrain from confiscatory taxation and refrain from arbitrary income redistribution. They would refrain from monetary inflation for the reasons we've already talked about. Decrease in the purchasing power of the dollar. They would refrain from monetary inflation because it promotes the business cycle and recession. Refrain from monetary inflation because of the redistributionary aspect and the destruction of the purchasing power of the dollar. All those things are negative consequences. And if you are an entity that is there to actually promote the general welfare, you don't want to harm the society in general to promote the welfare of your cronies, you know, or a handful of people in society. Mm-hmm.
So how do we hold the government accountable to that standard?
Well, I mean,
maybe it's a bit of an ambitious question.
That's the $64 question, or I'd say probably now the $128 question with inflation. in some sense, you have to have an informed citizenry that are willing to act on principle. I mean, we're in a really bad way, I think, now because, I mean, shortly after the financial meltdown of 2008, recession 2009, I know there's some statistics out there indicating that over half of the population was earning half or more of the material income somehow related to the state activity. Now, I don't know if that's still true, and I'm not exactly sure, to be honest, how they calculated it, but assuming that is true, that means that in order for people to be willing to restrain the state, to reduce the welfare state, to reduce regulation, to reduce the impetus for monetary inflation, people have to be willing to work against their short-run monetary incentives, right? Mm. And I think that's so, and that, of course, requires a significant amount of personal character in our culture. I'm not sure if we still have that in our culture, to be honest. I don't know if we have a critical mass of people, certainly a majority of people, that are willing to act on principle contrary to their short-run monetary interests. But that's why it takes education. People need to know that the inflation train, the debt train that we're on, cannot continue, and so we have to make decisions now to forestall a lot of bad things worse things happening in the future, that's going to require some short term pain for a lot of people, and nobody likes pain. Mm-hmm. It's a lot easier to ease your mind flipping through more TikTok videos and even intelligent people listening to podcasts like this. Mm-hmm. I think it's going to require fortitude. It's going to require holding politicians to the fire. It's going to require people actually voting on principle. Calling out so-called conservatives for just going along with business as usual, calling out people who call themselves conservatives, but then continue to vote for these gargantuan increases in government spending. it's going to require statesmen instead of politicians. Mm-hmm. Statesmen to tell people what they don't necessarily want to hear, but to tell them the truth. Mm-hmm. And so I think all of that is sort of a tall order in our mm-hmm. current era. And I guess on top of it, we could say this, just I am somewhat biased, but we need – that's now more than ever, we need institutions like Grove City College to be institutions like Grove City College, right? Mm-hmm. We need institutions that are private, that are willing to and can actually speak the truth on these issues.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's very good. And I guess the most fundamental level of that would be the populace educating themselves on these issues.
Yes.
To put that into action.
That's right.
So I guess that would naturally segue into another question I have. Where would be good places for our listeners and viewers to start educating themselves? Books, documentaries, lectures to listen to.
Sure. Well, I think that
I mean, obviously, reading your book goes without saying.
I'm going to say it anyway. No, I mean, it feels a little bit bad. I'm like tooting my own horn, but that would be a good book. I tell you what, my colleague and former student, Caleb Fuller, just, 3-4 years ago, published a book called No Free Lunch, based on a Life of the Mind lecture series he did for Grove City College. Mm. That's an excellent primer in understanding economic laws and how they apply in everyday circumstances. No Free Lunch. That would be an excellent book to start with. And then if you like that, maybe proceed to Foundations of Economics by Ritenour. I would say that I am a senior fellow at the Ludwig von Mises Institute. Every year, they do Mises University, and not only do they do it in person, but for several years, if not over a decade now, they have recordings of those lectures that are online for free on their YouTube channel. You can watch hours and hours of excellent economic education along those lines. Leonard Reed is a former is a Grove City graduate. He's the president of the Foundation of Economic Education. There's a lot of good education there that you can find at their website. The Institute for Faith and Freedom still does some good work in that regard. You can go to their website and read the material that they have that we have here, there's good economics that are out there. Mm-hmm. There's good podcasts out there. At the same time, you have to be – it's easy to sort of get overly inundated with information. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think the best thing you could do is take a book like Fuller or make a book like mine and just start reading through it and spending time with it and go for – in some sense, I would start going for quality instead of quantity. Mm-hmm. It's sort of really getting these principles down, the basic principles of economics down.
Yeah.
And then once you do that, a whole host of these other things begin to make more sense.
Mm-hmm. I guess to – maybe add a little bit more quantity to it. Just one thing I would chip on top of the pile there. For the life of me, I don't remember what it was called, but it was an old Milton Friedman series.
Oh, yeah.
I think it was called Free to Choose.
Free to
or something
Choose,
like
that's
that.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. I was just talking to my class about that. I was teaching History of Economic Thought, and so we were dealing with wrapping up monetarism and talking about his explanation for the Great Depression, which I don't necessarily completely agree with. I don't agree with it at all, by the way. Hmm. But nevertheless, there's many, many episodes of that program, Free to Choose, which was produced in 1980, which are excellent. His episode on the market is very good. His episode from Cradle to Grave is quite good. His episode on equality and inequality is very good. So that series is way more right than wrong. There's a lot that you could glean from that for sure.
Yeah.
Also, by the way, a PBS produced by PBS of all places called "The Commanding Heights" was a 3 or 4 part series that actually is also quite good. It was produced in the mid to late 90s, and it's not as well known as Friedman's Free to Choose, but it's an excellent. Excellent series as well, and it's not as long. It's maybe, like I said, 3 or 4 episodes.
Okay,
it's quite well done.
Right on. So, what's something? Because I mean, further along the topic of educating people, especially in an election year. What's something that you wish more people, and especially Christians, but the populace in general, understood about economics that you don't think a lot of them do?
I would say that economics is not about math, and economics is not about money and things. Economics is primarily about how humans are able to improve their life and the lives of their family through voluntary exchange. We understand that, then you'll find that the things that promote voluntary exchange tend to be socially beneficial. Things that hamper voluntary exchange tend to be socially destructive. And everything has a cost. There's no such thing as a free lunch, is a sort of a standard economic mantra, but it's cliche because it's true that every goodie that the government tries to provide us, whatever it is, free health care, art subsidies, green subsidies, every goodie that the government tries to give us has to be paid for by somebody somewhere. And so it all has a cost, and there is no mechanism for the government to demonstrate that the benefit of the goodie is greater than the cost, because they don't use profit and loss calculations based on prices that are manifestations of people's actual preferences. Mm-hmm. They make decisions based on bureaucratic will and political expediency. Provide goodies to the right people because they will vote for you. They have a good that they're supplying, which is the goodies, and they have a good that they're demanding, which is the votes, right? So that is something that I would like everybody to understand, is that every goodie that the government gives us comes with a cost. And so if the government provides something to somebody, that means somebody else is not getting something. We also know in general that government allocation and production is generally less efficient than the production of private entrepreneurs, because the government doesn't have an incentive to allocate goods efficiently, but the private entrepreneur does, because if the private entrepreneur makes a bad decision, he reaps the loss, right? The bureaucrat makes a bad decision. Well, the problem, of course, is we didn't spend enough money on it, so we get more money in our budget, right? So it's all – the whole thing's askew. Yeah. So, remembering that goods are scarce, and that therefore providing something for somebody comes at a cost. And that's a very important principle to remember.
Okay. Last question here, and you're going to absolutely love me for this question.
Oh, good.
Why is Titanic your favorite movie?
Well,
I'm kidding. Those of you who've had him in class will know that
it is not my favorite movie. It's one of the biggest pieces of celluloid, biggest lies on celluloid in film history.
Any of you who are in a class with him, just ask him about it in office hours or whatever. He has a very good explanation.
Yes.
For that.
Yes.
That was not my serious last question, but I figured those who knew would appreciate it.
Oh, sure. Well, I hope so.
No, my real question to wrap us up is just kind of bring it all home. Why should Christians care about economics?
Christians should care about economics because economic laws are part of creation. And so when we see economic laws manifested in creation, they declare God's glory, the same as the laws of thermodynamics, or the heavens declare God's glory, economic law declare God's glory. And there's certain, I think, right, you look at the heavens and God's glory is manifest in a particular way. I think if you look at the laws of economics, to say allow for, how is it that the multitudes of people in the world or in any given society can have their conflicting desires met in a peaceful way that doesn't result in armed conflict, doesn't result in anybody's, getting sent to the gulag, anybody's wife getting shot, anybody's compound being burnt down accidentally on purpose. It allows for people's conflicting interests to be satisfied peacefully. Mm-hmm. that is a marvelous thing. That's a beautiful thing to see. That people, it happens so in some sense almost automatically. We don't tend to notice it, but to be able to learn about economic law and see what's happening, we get a glimpse of God's glory in a way that we don't perhaps even see it if we look to the heavens. Hmm. On top of that, as I said, understanding economic law and then being able to use that to encourage people in the right way and encouraging people in say, proper realistic principles of production, encouraging and educating people, how is it that you can actually act productively to increase your income by serving other people? Mm-hmm. That's another, by the way, important principle I think everybody should understand, that in a market economy, people gain income only by serving other people. You don't become rich by serving yourself in a market economy. The only way to get income is to serve other people. So, you know, even the most greedy capitalist, you know, scoundrel can only, in a market economy, can only satisfy his greed if he serves somebody else. Mm. Right? In a more statist economy, the ruler can satisfy his greed by taking from somebody else.
And give kickbacks to his buddies.
Absolutely, yeah. What's not to like?
Yeah.
I would say, you know, understanding that the laws of economics are part of God's creation, and then formulating and advocating for economic policy in line of those laws is actually a way of loving our neighbor. It's a way for us to allow our neighbor to be as prosperous as possible. Lord willing, towards the end of human flourishing.
Hmm. Right on. Very good. Well, I'll just wrap up our episode here with this episode's reading of the Heidelberg Catechism. Lord's Day 24, question 62. But why can our good works not be our righteousness before God, or at least a part of it? Answer, because the righteousness which can stand before God's judgment must be absolutely perfect and in complete agreement with the law of God, whereas even our best works in this life are all imperfect and defiled with sin. Question 63. But do our good works earn nothing, even though God promises to reward them in this life and the next? Answer. This reward is not earned. It is a gift of grace. Question 64. Does this teaching not make people careless and wicked? Answer. No. It is impossible that those grafted into Christ by true faith should not bring forth fruits of thankfulness. Dr. Rittenour, thank you for coming on the show.
Thank you for having me.
This has been Keeping the Faith. I am your host, Joseph Wolcott, and I will see you all in the next episode.